Good evening to everyone, and welcome to those who are here for the first time, several people. This is the second week of a Dharma seminar series that I'm doing based on, but not strictly based on, this new book by Roshi Joan Halifax from Upaya Zen Center in New Mexico. It's called Standing at the Edge, Finding Freedom Where Fear and Courage Meet. And it's about how we live and practice on those edges. She calls it between fear and courage, right? I think pretty much all of us probably know something of what that feels like, you know? But it could also be the edge between success and failure, health and illness, even life and death. It feels like the whole world is on an edge, and in an edge state these days. So in the book, she chooses six of what she calls edge states to structure her discussion. Altruism, which we talked about last week. Empathy, integrity, respect, engagement, and compassion. And those, to me, they're not so much edge states in themselves, but capacities that we need to be and live and practice in edge states. And capacities that in themselves can have almost a shadow side, a bright side and a shadow side. And she looks at that for each one. So this week we'll look at empathy. The next one in the book. The word empathy is derived from the Greek empatheia, which means in passion or in feeling. So it's the capacity to be aware of, to feel into the feelings and mind states of others because they resonate in us, right? You've probably all had the experience of seeing someone else trip or startle, and then you flinch or startle yourself. You know what that feels like, right? It's a bodily reaction. It's involuntary. Maybe have you ever seen a bird take off like an eagle and felt a little twitch between your shoulders? I have. Or once, I actually was watching two eagles. It was a big pond, and there were two pairs of geese with their goslings. And you know how geese, when the goslings get a little bigger, they cluster the goslings together, and they all it's called a creche, and that gives them more safety than if they're divided into families. And the eagles were diving this cluster of goslings, and the four parent geese would just burst up out of the water in a big flurry, and the eagle would miss and then come back and try again and come back and try again each time. And I could feel this in my body, this kind of flying up that the parent geese were doing. So empathy, it can cross species too, can it? Sometimes we feel that across the peachy. The eagle gave up. It's hard work being a predator sometimes. A raptor. And you've all probably felt tears well up when someone else weeps. Especially in the darkness of the movie theater, where your inhibitions are lowered. We feel the ache of our friend's grief and the uplift of their joy. Yawning is contagious, right? So is laughter. All this is because we are born equipped with what are called mirror neurons. I'm sure some of you have heard of mirror neurons, which resonate when we see physical behaviors or emotional expressions in others. Even newborn babies start to respond to the facial and mirror the facial expressions of their closest caregivers. And these physical mirroring functions are believed to form the basis for a kind of emotional attunement and ultimately for the cognitive development that allows us to be able to take the perspective of another person, another being. For a child to develop what's called theory of mind. Have you ever heard? Theory of mind means that a child can imagine another person different from them and what they might be thinking or feeling. Right? So we all have these capacities, right? They're natural to us, but they need to be exercised for those neural pathways to develop. And there's and to be reinforced for us to function to our full potential. These are very complex, I think, body, brain, mind processes that really only recently are being researched and better understood. We're coming to understand that the cognitive, the somatic or body, and the emotional functions are intricately linked, we could say. And there are many ways that those capacities can be impaired in our development. The good news is that we can continue to develop these capacities well into adulthood and even into more advanced ages. But it takes intention and it takes practice. So Joan Halifax, in her book, describes three kinds of empathy which overlap and correspond to what I just mentioned. Somatic empathy is the feeling of physical resonance with another's experience. Like when we flinch when we see someone else get hit on TV or something, a movie. We all have this capacity, as I've said, but some people are actually hypersensitive in this way. Halifax talks about a neurologist named Dr. Joel Salinas, who has what's called mirror touch synesthesia. It's a condition where he feels the sensations of others or the pain of others with far beyond normal sensitivity. So in order not to be completely overloaded by the pain and difficulty of his patients, he uses a number of techniques that we could all benefit from, and I will come back to them. The second kind of empathy is emotional empathy, when we resonate with another person's emotional state. And that's really closely linked with somatic empathy, since our emotions arise from the neurophysiology of our attraction aversion patterns, right? How we react to threat, withdraw from threat, or reach out towards what we want is very much embodied. So that's how we also feel emotional empathy. So emotional empathy is essential to being able to care for others, but it can also overwhelm, or it can lead to a kind of dangerous identification, like with someone else's hatred. Right? The third kind of empathy is cognitive empathy, and that's our ability to take another person's perspective, as I mentioned, to see through their eyes. And again, that's based on our somatic and our emotional empathy, with the addition of our understanding, the understanding we bring to that resonance. So these capacities are essential to our life as social beings. And when they're impaired, our social lives are limited, constrained. And our moral and ethical lives can be impaired. Like with a narcissistic or antisocial personality structure, there's a lack of empathic capacity to care for others and the results of one's own actions. I think one problem is that our nervous systems evolved throughout most of human history in small tribal-sized or village-sized groups of about 200. Research has shown that about 200 is our capacity for facial recognition, which is interesting, you know, because the majority of human history, that's the size groups that we lived in. So we're not wired to take in a continuous flow of traumatic images and direct contact with human suffering. There have, throughout human history, been wars and violence and pestilence and disaster, no shortage of trauma. But an individual's experience of it would have been more limited in time and scope. You know, they didn't have news feed. So it's no wonder we experience empathic overload in our society, in our workplace environments, and beyond. This is natural that we feel overloaded, and it should be recognized and better supported. But compassion is something more than empathy. We need the capacity for empathy in order to have compassion. But compassion goes beyond simply resonating with another's suffering to an active extension of love and care to ease that suffering. Last week I mentioned Matthieu Ricard, who left a career in molecular genetics to become a Tibetan monk, Tibetan Buddhist monk. And he writes, he's worked a lot with neuroscientists studying the effects of meditation, particularly compassion meditation. So he was asked by researchers to alternate periods where he would induce a feeling of empathy by imagining someone suffering with periods of simply relaxing his mind in a neutral state. And here's what happened. And this was, without doing any meditation, he was supposed to just relax and be monitored by an MRI scan throughout this. So after the first session, the researcher asked him what he'd been doing, because the results were strange, different from what they usually were when they did this experiment with people. So Ricard explained that he had been meditating on unconditional compassion, trying to feel a powerful feeling of love and kindness for people who were suffering. When the researchers analyzed the data, they discovered that completely different parts of the brain were activated when he was doing his compassion practice than what they'd observed in people who were just empathizing with others' suffering. So when the parts of the brain that were activated in that case, when people were following the instructions to empathize with the sufferers, the parts of the brain that were activated were the parts associated with pain and emotional distress, right? So an identification with. Whereas the parts that were activated when Ricard was meditating on compassion were associated with the positive emotions, the feeling of affiliation, care, maternal love, different parts of the brain. So he agreed to do the experiment again and follow the instructions properly. So this time, he deliberately evoked feelings of empathy. He had just watched apparently a BBC documentary the night before about physically and mentally handicapped orphans in a Romanian hospital where they suffered from unbelievably extreme neglect, horribly neglected. And so this time he visualized the suffering of these children, alternating with short periods of rest. After an hour, he said he was exhausted and overwhelmed with feelings of helplessness and distress. So the researchers then asked him if he'd like to shift right away to the compassion meditation, which had been scheduled for later that afternoon. And he agreed with relief. And this is what he said. "Scarcely had I shifted the orientation of my meditation to love and compassion before my mental landscape transformed completely. The images of the children's suffering were still just as present and strong. I now felt a profound, heartwarming courage linked to limitless love for these children. Meditating now on compassion, I felt like I had opened a gate, loosing floods of love that permeated the suffering of these children." And again, the brain scans confirmed the difference. And confirmed our understanding that empathy alone can lead to overwhelm, fatigue, burnout. But when, as Ricard says, the empathy has passed through, he calls it, it's passed through the prism of altruistic love, it becomes compassion. So that altruistic love, we talked about altruism last week, love without self-clinging, without an agenda, just our courageous, loving determination to be with those who suffer. So from this point of view, love and compassion do not get exhausted and do not make us weary or worn out, but on the contrary, help us to surmount fatigue, give us courage. Joan Halifax in the book points to three ways empathy can become overwhelming or compromised. The first one she calls empathic arousal, so that's what we're referring to with overwhelm, you know, where we are feeling those symptoms of burnout, poor sleep, anxiety, shutting, sort of bottling up our own feelings. And related then to that is the second possibility, which is numbing or dulling. You know, when we're too overwhelmed, then we start to shut down. So this is often called compassion fatigue, but really it's kind of a misnomer. It's empathy fatigue. Sometimes those who are particularly susceptible to empathy fatigue are the very ones, the very people who are prone to very extremely high standards of perfectionism for themselves and rigid standards of self-judgment, a kind of self-sacrificing approach to caring for others. So these are important things to notice in ourselves. There's also a risk of what's called a kind of empathic blindness or impairment that sometimes it's associated with the autism spectrum or with personality disorders, where the individual has kind of an impaired empathic capacity and a difficulty reading others, which is also often accompanied by a difficulty in feeling and describing their own emotional states or visceral states. Now that's an extreme, maybe, you know, antisocial or psychopathic personality disorder is an extreme case, but I suspect we could all benefit from improving our emotional self-awareness and how we experience our emotional states in our bodies. How often have you heard someone say, "I'm not bad," or "I'm not scared," right? When it's obvious that they are. You may have said something like that yourself. Maybe you can see how greater self-awareness can help us regulate our empathic reactions so that our responses can be guided not by an identification with that person's pain, but with wisdom and compassion, plus skillful means, plus good timing. One more risk of unregulated or unmindful empathy is that our behavior can become unmoored. We can lose our moral and ethical compass. Our empathy can be so strong in one direction, for example, identifying very strongly with one group of people who might be oppressed or suffering, that we lose the larger picture and the potential harm that we might do with our words and actions. And how should we have empathy for those who cause harm, you know, for perpetrators? Here's where the confusion between empathy and compassion is important to clarify. Because we can have compassion for perpetrators, for those who do harm, because it comes from their deep confusion and suffering. But we don't have to empathize with them, with their distorted feelings, thoughts, and actions. I read a really thought-provoking book called The Empathy Exams a few years ago by Leslie Jameson. And in an interview with Harper's Magazine, she said this. She takes a number of in each essay, a different example of an experience where she learned about and struggled with empathy. One thing she did was volunteer with doctors, with gynecologists, as a subject to teach them how to have better bedside manner and ways of treating women, examining women. I thought that was a pretty noble thing for her to do. Anyway, this is what she says. "I'm interested in everything that might be flawed or messy about empathy. How imagining other lives can constitute a kind of tyranny or artificially absolve our sense of guilt or responsibility. How feeling empathy can make us feel we've done something good when we actually haven't. We start to like feeling, we start to like the feeling of feeling bad for others. It can make us feel good about ourselves. So there's a lot of danger attached to empathy. It might be self-serving or self-absorbed. It might lead our moral reasoning astray or supplant moral reasoning entirely. But do I want to defend it despite acknowledging this mess? More like, I want to defend it by acknowledging this mess." So we have to acknowledge the mess of our human relationships. How do we keep our mooring in this mess? The first practice Halifax recommends is body awareness. Being attuned to our body-mind processes helps us be aware of others, too. And also to know the distinction between self and other. You know, in Buddhism we talk a lot about know you, know me, we're all one, right? But there are two truths, the truth of the relative and the absolute. The absolute is the oneness of everything, and the relative is the particularity of everything. And those are simultaneous truths. Yes, we're all connected, but we also must be aware of distinctions. So that neurologist I mentioned, who is hypersensitive to the physical sensations of others, uses the sensation of his own breath to help him stay grounded and not be swept into his patient's pain. And sure enough, that's one of the very first things we teach in practice, learning meditation, is awareness of the breath. He also notices the subtle differences between his vicarious experience of others' feelings and his own present state. So this is how I feel now, and this is an arising that I'm picking up from someone else. He's learned to distinguish. He may even sometimes deliberately shift his attention to a neutral part of his body or a neutral person, so that very strong pain doesn't become overwhelming. And he also brings to mind his role as a doctor and his commitment to relieving his patient's suffering. So this is like using our bodhisattva vows to hold us upright and not be thrown down to the ground, or to pick ourselves back up when we are thrown down. So his techniques sound like practical bodhisattva advice to me. Another key practice that Halifax offers is deep listening. Listening with body, heart, and mind. Instead of jumping in with, oh, I know just exactly how you feel. When that happened to me, blah, 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 blah. Right? Instead, we might ask, how was that for you? And just listen. Just pay attention. It's important to temper empathy with not knowing, not to jump to assume that you know another's reality. And so that we don't contaminate our response with our own agenda, our own conditioning. That spacious not knowing place is so important, which we mentioned last week. Halifax, in her books, calls this attentiveness to the dance of self and other stewarding empathy. Stewarding empathy. What's it to be a good steward? It's to be careful of how much you... it's a balance. It's a balance of how much you spend and give. And that makes it sound like you're constantly calculating, but I don't think she means it that way. I think what she's talking about is when we feel ourselves teetering on the edge of empathic overload or numbing, that we need to practice equanimity, to remind ourselves that we can't control other people, let alone the whole world. Equanimity is one of the four Brahma Viharas practices: loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Sharon Salzberg is a Vipassana teacher who has taught these practices for decades. And here are the phrases she offers that we can use as reminders for practicing equanimity. So I'd just like you to sit, kind of maybe even close your eyes, unless you feel like you'll fall asleep if you do. And I'm just going to read these phrases, these equanimity phrases, and just let them penetrate. See how they might resonate in your body, heart, and mind as I read them. Uh, May I offer my care and presence unconditionally, knowing that it may be met by gratitude, indifference, anger, or anguish. May I offer love, knowing that I cannot control the course of life, suffering, or death. May I find the inner resources to truly be able to give. May I be peaceful and let go of expectations. May I accept things as they are. I'm going to add, may I accept myself when I have trouble accepting things as they are. And may I see my limits compassionately, just as I view the suffering of others. Okay, so thank you for doing just that little short contemplation. And maybe out of some of those phrases, there's something short that you can take forward that might be meaningful to you, that you can bring to mind when you feel yourself in an edge state this coming week. I think a take-home practice would be to notice when you're feeling like you're teetering, and perhaps one of those phrases would be helpful as a reminder to attend to body, heart, and mind. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. And I think we have time. Yes, we do. To ask you to get into small groups of three, and I'm going to ask you to each take a turn. Think of a situation when you've been on the edge of empathy fatigue and feel yourself overloading or numbing or getting confused about what to do. And just speak about what you feel comfortable speaking about in the group. You don't have to pick the hardest thing in your life, but an example that you can might be something in the past even. But what practices or perspectives that I've just discussed might have been helpful or might be helpful in that edge state of empathy fatigue.